You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Tuesday, September 22nd. Today we explore the mysterious thrills of a musical that lets the audience choose its ending. Stay tuned for clues to the Great Lakes Theatre Festival production, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and a chance to win tickets to that show. You'll also discover how rocker Carly Tanchin found her voice in Chagrin Falls and where she's taking it these days. But first, how an award-winning writer's literary garden grows. When Jamaica Kincaid's collection of essays, My Garden Book, was first published in 1999, one reviewer wrote, quote, "Reading her, I feel as though I am lying in a hammock on a balmy summer day, surrounded by a garden of lovely colors and intoxicating fragrances," end quote. Make no mistake, though, Kincaid's writings on gardening are not meant to be mere descriptions of pretty blossoms and how they grow. No, her essays and nonfiction books on the subject dig into the why of gardens and what they mean in the cultures where they exist. This afternoon, you'll have a chance to hear Jamaica Kincaid speak on the culture of green, nature, and the environment at Amasis Stone Chapel on the Case Western Reserve campus. The author joins us in Studio 4 of Idea Center for today's Around Noon. Welcome, Jamaica Kincaid.
Thank you very much. So nice of you to have me.
I wanted to talk about growing up on the Caribbean island of Antigua and what your relationship with gardens was when you were a child and a teenager there.
In places like Antigua, you really don't have gardens in the way I've come to have them. You have the Botanic Garden, which is an expression of empire, in that it had in it specimens of the vegetable kingdom from the far-flung reaches of the British Empire. So you'd have something that was native to parts of Africa, native to parts of Asia, and so on and so on, but hardly anything that was native to the West Indies. So that was one kind of garden. Then there was the kind of garden that someone like my mother would make, which was to grow things she needed for cooking or for medicine, or sometimes for something she liked to see in bloom. That was more rare. So my relationship to gardening was sort of one half of the, well, maybe not one half, maybe the whole story of the Garden of Eden. I don't know if you know, I'm sure you know, but just to tell you what I mean, in the story of the Garden of Eden, the tree of life comes before the tree of knowledge. It's the way the narrative goes. Life comes first. And I also think that the tree of life is agriculture, and that the tree of knowledge is horticulture, and that horticulture is the thing you do after you have have sufficient from the tree of life, sufficient to eat. And after people have enough to eat, they tend to then go into growing things, sure, just for their own beauty, just for their own appreciation. And it's in that way you get acquire a bit of knowledge. as a child, I think my favorite subject, I had three favorite subjects, really: history, geography, and botany. Uh-huh. And we were taught botany as a subject, though it was a way of, I think, acquainting us with science. You know, what is a leaf? How does a leaf work on a tree? What does a tree do? And so on. So, and I love that. So I can see that, the love of botany, the love of geography, because if you love botany, you have to go see how the plants grow. Right. And geography is a very big part of a garden. I think I answered you more than you wish to know. But
actually, I wanted that much detail because it's a subject that weaves in and out not only of the essays that you write specifically about it, but in and out of the novels that you write, as you're setting that place and time on and off on and off the island. But you also write about the effects of British colonialism, and I wanted to hear what your take is on the relationship of gardening in that sense, of how it's an extension of that colonial attitude.
Oh, absolutely. One thing that's always interesting to see is that before the discovery, let's say, to call it just for shorthand's sake, exploring of what came to be called the New World, this part of the world, and then exploring and conquering, say, parts of the Old World, Africa and Asia, European gardening was more about architecture. It was more about how the garden was constructed. It was only after they met places where flowers were colorful and unusual that the garden came to be full of flowering things, and came color became a part of gardening life. But European gardening was about the, again, you can go back to the biblical story. It was about the architecture of the garden. It was the garden, the classical garden, in many European traditions, would be divided into four quarters, the way the Bible it says, you know, the Garden of Eden is divided by these four rivers. That's the classical architecture of a garden. It was only when people began to go to Asia. The British would send people to India and into the Himalayas, in the high parts of the Himalayas, where they found plants that were cold hardy, though sometimes on a latitude with Cuba, say, but some places same latitude as Cuba in Asia, had very high mountains, so the plants were cold hardy and suitable for a European climate. But they were very beautiful. Rhododendrons, for instance, is a good example, and roses, different kinds of roses, different kinds of trees. A great part of a European garden comes from Asia, or garden in our country. A great part of it comes from Asia. A great part of it comes from Latin America. A lot of it is native to us. But really, when you think of, beautiful things, lilies and so on, well, they come from the discovery of new parts of the world, or the conquest of new part of the world. Mm. And conquest is a, you know, a big part of colonialism, to colonize, to settle, to claim, and from afar to impose. So gardens are very much a part of the colonial enterprise, or gardens as we come to know it, and mm-hmm. as we practice it. There's a wonderful book by a woman from Zimbabwe. Her name is Sitsi Degarambega, and in a part of it, the heroine, a young girl, she sees canna lilies growing outside somebody's garden, somebody's gates, as she passes by a European house. She sees them growing canna lilies, and she's shocked because she's never seen flowers grown just
for beauty,
just for their beauty, just for the sheer existence, their sheer existence, and they offer nothing but beauty. Mm. Well, to say nothing, well, you know, yeah, what I mean.
I do. I do. I wonder, when you came to New York from Antigua, if you tried to maintain that connection to nature, or if that wasn't something that was on your mind at that point in time. Mm.
Wasn't on my mind at all at that time. The person I became interested in all these things that were the foundation for which were laid in my childhood, I didn't know. In fact, I very much wanted to get away from it. There's a book I wrote, and in it I write about coming across daffodils for the first time. I'd never seen a daffodil all my childhood, but I know very well, I knew very well, had to know very well, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by William Wordsworth. And as a child, I hated the poem without knowing why. And I remember seeing daffodils growing in Central Park for the first time and wanted to kill them. It was a sort of rage without knowing that they were daffodils. I have since, in my house in Vermont, I have, in honor of Wordsworth, planted 10,000 of them on the lawn.
Oh my.
And every spring I have a kind of daffodil tea party. But no, I didn't know. I didn't consciously bring any of it with me. As I became myself, as I, you know, blossomed, so to speak, in the world that I came to know in the United States, I became very interested in gardens and became very interested in history. The two are very connected. And, of course, in geography. I now live somewhat in California and have taken it upon myself to go visit cracks in the earth, otherwise known as the San Andreas Fault. But yes, it's amazing to go see this part of the earth where it's just riving apart, you know. Where it's visibly, it's there, but you just don't see it all the time. There are parts where you can really see where, you know, it's just coming apart. So
Which is thrilling and scary at the
same
time.
It's very scary. It's awesome, as my children say, awesome.
I'm talking with Jamaica Kincaid, and this afternoon you can hear her speak on the campus of Case Western Reserve University. She is the annual Annisfield Wolf Sages Lecture today at 4:30 p.m. on the Case campus. It's a free event and a joint presentation of Case Western Reserve's Baker Nord Center for Humanities, the Cleveland Public Library, and the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. And Jamaica Kincaid joins us in Idea Center at Playhouse Square for today's Around Noon. And I was thinking about the book I mentioned when I started talking in the introduction, My Garden Book, essays that were written, a lot of them, when you were working at the New Yorker magazine.
Yes.
I was curious how people who read those essays at that time when you wrote them responded to them.
Oh, they generally met with a good response, I would say. In fact, I think a great part of my reading, public, comes from them. People rather liked them. One in particular was controversial, but only to a certain group of people who are part of something called the Garden Conservancy, which is just a bunch of very well-off people who make very nice gardens, spectacular gardens, and which is one of the things you do when you have a lot of money, because a garden is very expensive. And they make gardens, and they speak to each other, and they invite each other to see their gardens, and they invite the public to see their gardens, and so on. They're very, I don't want to say elite, because I like elites, but they're very silly. in their way, amusingly silly. Mm. They're not evil, they're just silly. Mm. But one of them, a Mr. Frank Cabot, had invited me to some event held in of all places, and you can see how peculiar these people are, that they would hold it in Charleston, South Carolina, that infamous place. And I had planned to give a nice talk about gardens and so on. But outside the place where the event was held was a statue of, what's his name? He's going to escape me now. That very infamous vice president who was,
An historical figure.
Yes,
who?
He was Monroe's vice president. Oh. And supported slavery. He was the one who, I think, I'm quite sure I've researched this, he's the one who really made the idea of states' rights into the right to hold slaves. I think he was quite the first person to articulate it that way. This is the history part of it. And there was a statue to him, John, oh dear, it will come first. Anyway, he was there was a statue celebrating him outside the event. And I found that offensive, but I didn't mean to say anything about it until someone gave a talk on a garden that was made by some people who were about to be murdered in Auschwitz, and before they were carted off, they had made a very nice garden, and he made a talk about this garden, which was a lovely talk. But I thought, how peculiar that all of this history was outside, and we were talking about another kind of history, and it was this Charleston, which anyway, it was very disturbing. So I completely abandoned my talk and gave a talk about the relationship between gardening and cruelty, and not just cruelty, but political violations. So the man, Mr. Cabot, later said to me, there was an after dinner party at a plantation called Middleton, and he said that I had introduced politics into the garden, and that he regretted asking me to come. Mm. Well, Middleton, the estate of Middleton, was a slave plantation, and in fact, not far from where we were having this lovely dinner was a pile of rubble that Sherman had brought to the ground. I like Mr. Sherman very much. And anyway, so as he was cursing me out, really, for bringing politics into the garden in Middleton, which has a spectacular garden, including a pond that's in the shape of a butterfly, and the pond's water was used to fill out, to wash out the rice fields, wash out the salt from them, and the rice fields, of course, were cultivated by slaves. But the whole plantation is a beautiful garden, as it is a plantation of food. So I said to him, "Oh well, that's, you know, good of you to say that. But by the way, Mr. Middleton was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence," and so that's the only disagreeableness I've had. But my point, I hope was well made, that here we were in this beautiful garden that was made by slaves, and the man who made it was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. So the idea that politics is removed from gardening, I thought was a good example of it. But it's not the only one.
And it makes me wonder, when you speak this afternoon, if that's the sort of landscape that you'll be covering, the nature of green and what it means in the world today.
Oh, well, somewhat, you know. I'd be glad if people are willing to hear it again, but today I was reading the newspaper, and there was an article about these wind farms that are very crucial to clean energy and so on. Well, they probably will make an enormous number of birds extinct, because, and I never thought of that, and I think most people who are, you know, we all want clean energy, but there's a price we pay. Yes, the greenness of the earth is really important, but we have to really think hard about it. And I think we Americans are not really used to thinking that things cost something. Mm. You know, we are not used to, it's not that we're not used to thinking about it. We're not used to having to face it. Right.
We don't follow the chain of consequences.
Yes, that things are fine, that there isn't a price to be paid for anything. And people will say, oh, it's this generation or that generation. But you go back to the whole of American history and the grandness of us, we don't think it comes at the cost of anybody at all, you know.
I suspect that there will be people thinking this afternoon as you're speaking. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's really a great pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you very much for having me and allowing me to spout off.
My guest has been Jamaica Kincaid, the award-winning novelist and nonfiction author who's written extensively on the subject of gardens. She'll speak on that subject and related ones this afternoon at 4:30 in a free lecture at Amasis Stone Chapel on the Case Western Reserve campus in University Circle. The event is co-presented by CWRU's Baker Nord Center for Humanities, the Cleveland Public Library, and the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. Though the lecture is free and open to the public, online registration is encouraged. You can find out more when you log on to the Around Noon section of our website and look for links. That's online at WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand and comment on what you hear. Up next, a musical mystery that gives the audience a choice on how to end the show. Actually, a lot of choices. Find out more as we discuss the Great Lakes Theater Festival production, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Imagine the greatest writer of his age sitting down at his writing table to pen the most anticipated story of his career, and then, without warning, midway through his story, he's struck dead on the spot with the mystery of his novel never solved. This, in fact, did happen way back in 1870 when the great Charles Dickens passed away before completing his final tale, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Well, thanks to award-winning composer Rupert Holmes, that mystery was solved, at least sort of. This Saturday night, Great Lakes Theater Festival stages Drood, the Tony winner for Best Musical from 1985, at the Hanna Theater with a run through November 1st. We have tickets to give away to this production, so do stay tuned. But first, joining me now to tell us about this Victorian romp is the show's director, Vicki Buzzard. Vicki, welcome back.
Thank you, Dee.
Let's start with the origins of the musical and the man who created it, Rupert Holmes. Who's he, and how did this show come about?
Rupert has always been fascinated with mysteries, and the mystery of Edwin Drood really is probably the greatest mystery of all time because of the fact that Charles Dickens literally had only sketched, he had published three of 12 episodes, had sketched another three. So literally, he had only gotten halfway through when he did die. And Rupert has always been intrigued by mysteries and had really the brilliant idea of musicalizing this and bringing it to Central Park. The public first produces in Central Park, and then it moved to Broadway.
But not a straight rendition of the mystery itself.
Well, no, unlike the mystery, well, you know, because it is incomplete, we had to have somebody provide the ending, and that literally is the audience. So we have, I think, multiples around 40 different combinations of endings that we have rehearsed and are ready to do. So literally you can choose any leading character in the production to be the murderer for that evening. And we have about a 5-minute notice.
So you could see the show on any given night and see a totally different.
Correct, because the audience literally has to vote on three different things in the show, and it could be any combination any night.
Oh, my. Well, the musical is staged as a Victorian music hall show. What does that mean about what we see on stage?
Well, I have to mention my collaborators, Martine Cespedes as on choreography and Matthew Webb on music. It really means that wonderful sort of raucous, lively atmosphere of a British music hall, which is you know, very audience involved, audience participation, and it's a rowdy evening.
Because of the audience or the cast?
Yes, that too. We have a rowdy cast, though. It's quite fun to perform. It's sort of unlike any other musical that I'm familiar with.
Really? And did you see productions of it, of The Mystery of Edwin Drood?
This is actually my third production that I've directed over the past 20 years. But I had seen the original way back when, and I enjoyed it. I think I saw it two or three times because I enjoyed the concept so much and the voting process. I thought it was kind of astounding that, you know, the show literally has different lyrics, different music, depending on who is voted as the murderer.
That's pretty amazing. And I can't think of anything else like it in
theater. No, literally, once the murderer is elected, you know, you hear the orchestra turning pages to get to the correct music.
Well, as I mentioned, the show won the Tony for Best Musical back in 1985. And I'm curious about that win. I mean, if they were voting on a particular performance that they saw or just the concept.
Well, you know,
general.
It was really loaded with stars. I mean, people young in their careers, but Howard McGillin, who went on to do 10 years of Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. Betty Buckley was the original Drood. I mean, all these George Rose was the original chairman. It was quite an astounding star cast early in their careers.
Yeah. And let's lay out the basic storyline as well as we can before we get to
the end. The basic storyline is Edwin Drood is engaged to be married to the beautiful Miss Rosa Budd. And of course, there's a jealous music teacher of Rosa Budd who'd also like to be with her. There is the Reverend Chris Sparkle. There's sort of your normal cast of mystery characters. And ultimately, after a dinner party, Drood is discovered dead. And you have to decide who is the possible, and everybody, of course, is a possible murderer.
Right.
So,
whoa. We're going to hear a song from The Mystery of Edwin Drood, Both Sides of the Coin. How does this fit into the show?
That's funny because Both Sides of the Coin is sort of a classic music hall number. The way this production is set up, the way the script is written, is it is a music hall repertory company performing The Mystery of Edwin Drood. And this is one of these numbers that we see probably has been put into any production of any show that they do. So it's sort of woven in an unlikely way, but it's just pure fun British music hall between the leading man of the company and the chairman, the sort of the man who is in charge of the whole proceedings.
Let's listen to Both Sides of the Coin on 90.3.
I am not myself these days, for all I know I might be you. There's more than room enough for two inside my mind.
I am likewise in the haze of who I am from scene to scene. What's more, we two, we four, I mean, are in a bind.
For is it I, or is it me?
And if I'm him, and if I'm me, each one of us might not agree on what to do.
And if I take opposing sides within myself, then who divides of what is right or wrong?
I'll go along with you.
Penny, one penny, twopenny, threepenny, twelve to a shilling, twice that to a florin, and would you not fancy the currency foreign to find the same face on both sides of the coin? Barbers your ankle from pennies to guineas to twos, I'd invent the rule, not exception, and would you not feel quite a fool of deception to find the same face on both sides of the coin?
Music from the Tony-winning Broadway cast of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This weekend, the Great Lakes Theater Festival stages this musical favorite at the Hanna Theater. We have tickets to give away a little later, so do stay with us. Meanwhile, I'm here with the show's director, Vicki Bussert, and we're joined now by two of the show's stars, Alec Davies and Sarah Bruner. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Now, Alec, you play the chairman. Explain your role in the show and a little bit about that character.
The chairman functions sort of as the MC or host. He serves to introduce the characters in the story, and the device the author has used is that he's informing the regulars in the music hall crowd, look, here's your favorite leading man, and he calls him by name. Tonight he's playing this character. So expositionally, in the first part of the show, we're introducing the various players from the repertory company and the roles they're in Edwin Drood. And then he serves as the narrator and the timekeeper for changes of location and next day and so. And then in the second act, I have the enormous fun of presiding over the voting.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I want to get to how that works in just a bit. But I'm also wondering if it's clear whether the chairman is a good guy, a bad guy, or we don't know.
My chairman is a very good guy.
Yeah.
He likes... our conceit is that he's an actor-manager type of this repertory music hall company. And so it's his money on the line. He wants the show to be a success because he wants to sell a lot of tickets. And he also enjoys his interaction. I'm the character who has the most interaction with the audience.
But could you also be a choice for them as the murderer?
Not as the murderer in our production. No, I believe.
No. Yeah, you are not a.
No, but wasn't there an option in other productions that the chairman could be?
Oh, not that I know of.
Okay.
I know we had an audience member in Idaho who kept claiming that he was the murderer, and he kept saying that's not an option.
See, in my mystery experience, it's always the guy you don't suspect.
No, I try to absent myself from that decision. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, you meanwhile wear the pants in this production, so to speak, as you play the title character, Edwin Drood. How does casting a woman in the role enliven the proceedings?
Well, I think since it is a music hall performance, that's one of the conceits that was used very often in the music hall. And so it sort of helps it sort of helps build that feeling in the theater a little bit more. There were a lot of very famous male impersonators at the turn of the century, and so I think Rupert threw that in there just as sort of an extra bonus and to spice it up, and also to add a couple of interesting layers into the piece that wouldn't normally be there if Drood were portrayed by a man.
Mm. And so as you are portraying Drood, does that call for some physical changes?
Yeah, it does. It calls for physical changes because he's a masculine character, but also because, again, of the style of the music hall, sort of trying to embody what that might look like physically, as opposed to behaving really regularly, like I perceive a man like Drood to behave. I try to infuse into that also the music hall style to punch it up a little bit.
So you're playing a guy playing another guy of a probably different class, because I'm thinking the music hall performers would be sort of middle to lower class, and Edwin
right.
Drood might be sort of an upper crust kind of guy.
Yeah, he is an upper crust kind of guy, which also lends itself to being able to send it up. You know, a lot of the male impersonators that were very famous, there was social commentary involved in their performance. And of course, anytime you have one gender portraying the other, it's sort of inevitable that a little bit of making fun takes place. And also within the classes, you have that as well. So I definitely get a chance to sort of play with, you know, not only the masculinity, but also his upper crust, as you said, status.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And then there's the voting. Where in the production does that come?
It comes in Act Two, when literally the production comes to a complete halt because that's all that Charles Dickens had written. So when he put down his pen, we stopped the production as well. And the chairman takes over in truly, I think, one of the most difficult roles in musical theater, not to sing, but to act. It's sort of the musical theater version of a Lear. It is quite difficult and brilliantly done by Allied, but he literally has pages upon pages in terms of laying out all the votes that need to take place. And some of them are done by applause, so he literally has to decide who won. The murderer is done by a show of hands. We have people who literally go out into the audience. We've divided the house up so that even though while you're voting, you're not aware of how other sections are voting, so that we all discover the murderer at the same time when it's announced on stage.
And when it is announced, then does the production rev back up again and sort of say, okay, now it's this person and this is what we continue forward with.
Exactly. Now it's this person, and right there they confess. They have a musical confession. And again, each character has a different musical confession with different music and different lyrics. So it's quite exciting.
Yeah. How is it for you as the performer? I mean, what does that mean in terms of what you've got to be ready to do?
Well, for me, it's so easy. Right. I just get to sit back and enjoy. Yeah. I get to watch the frenzy backstage. So that's what a real show is.
Yeah. Tell me about that. What's going on backstage once they announce who's killed you?
Well, the first, there's a large voting section, and then the actors come back, and it's when the votes are being tabulated. And there's a lot of pacing. There's a lot of rehearsing. Everyone is making sure, you know, just to make sure, like, if it's me, I'm ready right now to go. Because sometimes someone might go a week, 2 weeks, a month without ever having performed it. So it's really up to the actor to always know that it's right there at the tip of their tongue. So, you know, there's a lot of anxiety and excitement. Backstage waiting for all of that to go down.
Yikes.
And we literally post for the audience on their way out. We post what the tally was so everybody knows what characters got how many votes.
And Alan, for you on stage, what's happening? You're doing what at this point?
Well, once I've led the audience and the company through the voting, I'm actually in pretty good shape because the burden is on everybody else.
So you're basically standing back saying,
yeah,
that
that's right.
Me.
I'm done. I just have to say, okay, now, because it's very cleverly done. The votes are taken and are taken backstage and are being tallied, and the action continues on stage. So the two actresses on stage do not know if they're involved.
Ooh.
We actually have to have a special system to alert them in case one of them is the murderer.
Isn't that so?
Because everybody else backstage knows. So the action goes forward, and then we get to the point of the murderer, which is always fun because I sort of make it a point not to ask because I like to actually be a little surprised with what's going on. And then we have our own twist. Rupert Holmes added his own twist to the story by suggesting that we should determine some lovers, which is when it becomes really anarchic in the audience because they've had their murder and now they get to vote on who gets to fall in love.
So you can pair any two characters, any woman with any man in
and
the cast.
And it will work musically and the audience will, the orchestra will be able to do it. So the audience
sounds
gets
like
to
a
go,
free-for-all.
Yes.
It is because every woman and every man who's a lover has their own dialogue depending on who is voted as the other lover.
Well, this is just great fun. I can't wait to see this unfold on stage. Thank you all and good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
My guests have been the Great Lakes Theater Festival's Vicki Bussert, Alet Davies, and Sarah Bruner. This weekend, they raised the curtain on the 1985 Tony winner for Best Musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. That production is running through November 1st at the Hanna Theater in Playhouse Square. For more information, the number is 216-241-6000. That's 216-241-6000. Or just log on to our homepage today online at wcpn.org, where you can hear the show on demand and comment on what you hear. Right now, though, we have another set of digits for you to dial to win tickets to see this show. Give us a call at 216-578-0903 with your name, address, and your 90.3 membership number. Those who've not won something in the last 30 days are eligible, and ticket vouchers will be mailed to your address. That's two tickets to the Great Lakes Theater Festival's production of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, or the play that's running in repertory with it, Twelfth Night, with performances September 24th through November 1st. For the first three callers at 216-578-0903 right now. Your vouchers will be mailed to you, and thank you for supporting 90.3. Coming up, a Chagrin Falls native returns home to share her sultry sound at the Beachland Ballroom. Stay tuned to hear from Carly Tanchin as you're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. It is 12 minutes before 1 o'clock as you're tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
I've been waiting, just sitting and waiting and playing with my pillow, looking looking for new ways to lay, to sleep, to fall back asleep.
All this waiting. Like many of us, Carly Tangen is tired of waiting, whether it's waiting for her chance in the spotlight, waiting to get back home to Northeast Ohio, or just waiting on hold for this interview to start. So the Chagrin Falls native joins us now to share her experiences as an emerging singer-songwriter, who recently released her debut album, Peridot, after graduating from Boston's Berklee College of Music. Her raw, rootsy folk sound has been praised with comparisons to Sheryl Crow and Bonnie Raitt, and this Sunday night she's back home for a gig at the Beachland Ballroom. Carly Tangen joins me now by phone from her new home base in Nashville. Carly, thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be on the phone with you.
Well, I want to start with how your childhood in Chagrin Falls sparked your interest in performing. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I moved around a lot growing up, too, and Chagrin Falls was always the home base. And my mom started me in music from the time I was about 3 years old, and as that went on, I did musical theater and took music lessons and everything like that right up until I decided to go to college and then decided it was all or nothing. And, and I gave in to the music thing very willingly.
And I want to make sure I'm saying the album's name right. Is it Peridot? Peridot?
Peridot.
Peridot.
That is it's actually the August birthstone, which is my mother's birthstone.
Ah. And I've heard of that birthstone, but I was never quite sure how to say it. So thank you.
Yeah, certainly.
Now, you dedicate the album to your mother and that birthstone is part of it, but how did her sort of foundation help you to do what you do?
Well, you know, believe it or not, when my mother was about my age, she was the lead singer in a country band down south.
Really?
And from the time I was 3 years old, she, as I said, she got me started in music, and she has just been the biggest supporter. And that, you know, with my father and brother as well, I feel very lucky to have the supportive family that I do.
But not in a stage mother sort of way, as in you're going to live out my dreams.
Right. Oh, no, definitely. Definitely. She always says that she hopes I chase my dreams while I still have cartilage in my knees.
Oh, gee. Well, you participated in musicals at Chagrin Falls High School. But your songs don't sort of have that musical theater feel. They're more kind of in the rock folk vein, I think.
Definitely. From the time I was about 14, I started playing in restaurants and things like that. I had a good friend who played guitar, and we both studied from the same guitar teacher. And we started doing gigs like that from the time we were 14, as I said, and that just carried in all the way through the end of high school. And actually, the two of us ended up going to college together in Boston at Berklee.
Oh, very cool. Well, let's hear some of the music from the CD a little bit more.
Certainly.
This is Carly Tangen with Lilies as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
You gave me lilies to breathe on me. That you're willing and I'm worth your nights spent alone. So fill this place while I loved you. But after time I found that all I knew were those late night walks around town and how
music from Chagrin Falls native Carly Tangen, who returns home this Sunday night for a show at the Beachland Ballroom. She joins us by phone from Nashville. And Carly, did you go from Boston to Nashville in one straight shot, or were there other stops along the way?
That's a good question. while I'm in Nashville now, I certainly still do a good amount of traveling. I finished school in December of 2006, actually, but ended up sticking around Boston for another couple of years, and I was playing with a touring cover band for a while and played out in Las Vegas and corporate parties in Washington, D.C., and traveled all over the country with them. And then at that point, actually just about a year ago, I picked up and decided to make the move to Nashville and really focus on my original music and really hone in on my songwriting and start pursuing the dreams I've kind of always set out to pursue. So
yeah, because I'm thinking, even though playing in a cover band and doing that sort of traveling you were talking about is something that keeps body and soul together, it doesn't really satisfy that creative spirit, I'm thinking.
Exactly. Well, I think the thing is, you know, I love entertaining. I love being on stage. I think there's something really incredible about being able to connect with an audience in any way, shape, or form. I've always been one to say, when I'm on stage and people in the audience are talking and things like that, you know, a lot of times an artist can be frustrated with that. But for me, if I'm sitting there entertaining and everybody's having a great time, that's what it's all about to me. And I felt like I reached a point where I wanted to focus on my original music more, because I feel like it's just a really amazing way to be able to connect with people. And I always try to do what I can. I don't really lie in my songs. I don't embellish very much. I just try to be very honest and let what I write be a window to who I am. And hopefully my listeners feel that when they listen to my music, they can get to know me better on a personal level.
Well, for instance, there's a song of yours, Blue Jay, where you sing about settling for a 9-to-5 job in the suburbs with kids.
Yeah.
Did you think that that was a possible future?
For a while I did. You know, I think you can go through relationships, and I think we become very comfortable with the idea of certainty in our society. And if I've learned anything in my few short years, and I think especially not to touch on a bad subject, but everything that's going on with the economy and everything, I think we've all learned that our ideas of certainty are much more mythical than I think we realize. And at any moment, things can change. And I think for a while, I was kind of afraid of what I kind of big things I could accomplish. And it was easy to think that a life like that would have been fulfilling enough. And then one thing leads to another, and you realize that you're destined for even bigger things than I think you thought.
Yeah. Let's hear a bit of Blue Jay as you're listening to Around Noon on 90.3.
It'll fade in time.
My guest is Carly Tanchin, a Chagrin Falls native and multi-talented singer-songwriter who performs at the Beachland Ballroom this Sunday, September 27th at 8:30 p.m. Carly joins me by phone for today's Around Noon. And Carly, many of the reviews of your music have said your sound is much more mature than they expect from a 22-year-old. Do you feel like music business vets treat you differently because of your age? Or is that more the reviewers sort of looking for a hook?
You know, I think it kind of depends. You know, I think you're put in different categories and things like that. And it's so easy to want to adapt to whatever you feel like people are gravitating toward in your delivery. However, I definitely, as I said, try to be genuine to who I am. And I think there is a maturity that comes across in what I'm portraying, but it's just honesty at its best, I suppose.
Yeah, it's who you are. And that's not a bad thing. Well, it's really cool that you get a chance to come home to Cleveland to perform, and we're looking forward to the gig. Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Oh, thank thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you, Carly. My guest has been Carly Tanchin, a Chagrin Falls native who returns to her hometown this Sunday for a gig at the Beachland Ballroom at 7 p.m. For more information, the number is 216-383-1124. That's 216-383-1124. Carly's debut CD is Peridot, and for more on her and her music, you can log on to WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand and comment on what you hear. Tomorrow around noon, we broadcast live from beneath the Detroit Superior Bridge with James Levin for the first ever Bridge Project. For today, our thanks to Jeff Carlton, our Around Noon intern Danielle Sills, and Around Noon producer Dave DiOrio. I'm Dee Perry. Good afternoon.
But here, call up, put your head on my shoulder, hold my face, keep saying that I
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.